singing along with this. We've got the man himself on the line. Geoffrey Morgan, who has interviewed the man about whom Iggy Pop, the embittered godfather of punk, said, "Geoffrey, you're a smart ass, watch it." Rock Critic Confidential by Geoffrey Morgan. If there is a safe space for rock stars, this isn't it. Veteran Cream magazine editor Geoffrey Morgan. Pick some of the finest and the most scurrilous, the most memorable bits of rock journalism in the past 50 years in a handy coffee table format. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere. Are you over in Canada this morning? Geoffrey, where do we find you today?
Good afternoon to Giles in sunny Spain from Geoffrey Morgan in sunny Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
The miracle of modern communication, my dear friend.
My friend, you have no idea. I have done everything that I have done. I have done basically from sitting in my living room in Toronto.
There are probably worse places to be for it. I mean, you could be out there, you know, somewhere near Arkansas, plugging a book tour or something like that. So there you go. Tell me a little bit, for those who don't know, the man, the myth, the legend, indeed, that is your career. How did it all start? Because I mean, I'm a sort of journalist, and I sort of fell into it backwards without looking. How did you get involved working on Cream?
Thanks to God, everything that I've ever done, Giles, has fallen into my lap. Started in 1966, I wrote a letter to Batman comic book, and they printed it. And so in the late 60s and early 70s, I wrote letters to Marvel Comics.
Right.
And Marvel Comics printed most of my letters, about a dozen of them, in various comic books. And then I moved on to rock and roll. I'd always been interested in rock and roll. But I started reading Cream magazine, and I started writing letters to Cream. And more often than not, they printed them. And that was basically all that I did. And Lester Bangs, in the summer of 1974, wrote me a letter, which is published in the first page of Rock Critic Confidential, and he asked me to write for the magazine.
Now, for those who don't know, Lester Bangs is the mother node, isn't he? He is the Obi-Wan Kenobi of rock critic and rock music journalism.
He is basically referred to as America's greatest rock critic. And Lester Bangs is the man that everybody wanted to emulate and everybody wanted to work for. We started out doing a lot of things, but I ended up reading his writing first in Rolling Stone in the late 60s and early 70s, and then he went to Cream, and that's where... Now, here's the interesting thing is, which is actually astonishing, is I never wanted to be a writer. I didn't know that I could be a writer. It was nothing that interested me when I was in high school. I wrote about rock and roll. When I went to see the Rolling Stones in 1972, I wrote a concert review for my own entertainment.
Right.
But I never had any inclination to do any writing. I didn't know I could write. But based on the letters that I was sending to Cream, and this is how selfless the man is, there's no reason why Lester Bangs in Michigan should be selfless and kind enough to extend an invitation to a kid who is writing letters to the magazine who lives in another country. That was very, very generous of him. And until he did that, I had no idea that I was doing anything of any value to anybody except cracking wise and writing letters. But as it says on the first page of the book, Lester wrote me a letter and he said, "You always write us witty letters, even if we never print them, all of them. So why don't you try your hand at writing record reviews?" And because of that, if it hadn't been for that letter that Lester Bangs sent me, which was unsolicited, because all my friends and everybody that I've ever been in contact with, they wanted to write for Cream. They wanted to sent in samples of their writing. This was something they wanted to do. I never sent in samples of my writing to anybody. I never asked for a job. I never met with anybody, and God has been gracious enough to give me a 50-year career that is ended up in the publication of Rock Critic Confidential, which is published by Nuvave and Books in England. And I live in Canada. My publisher's company is in England, and my publisher lives in Norway. So, and here's the punchline, too. Everything that I've ever done, Giles, I never asked for a job. I never met anybody in person. I never solicited any work. It was all opportunity just kept knocking on the door. And thanks to God, I had the ability and the talent to run with it and do what I've done. But I never wanted to paraphrase Alice Cooper in Desperado. You know, someone handed me this job and I gave it everything.
Absolutely. But the thing is, I mean, going down a blind alley, if you like, here. I mean, I quote unquote do a bit of writing, and, you know, I've got a couple of magazines on the go now and again after the COVID. And I get people come up to me and say, you know, how do you become a journalist? And I say to them, well, have you got a blog? Do you write into people? And they go, no. I said, well, that's what you got to do. And this is obviously what happened with you, Jeffrey. You know, it's like I said, you kept banging away, and then, you know, you show dedication and enthusiasm and probably a little bit of talent, my friend.
I didn't bang away at anything. All I did was write wiseacre letters to a rock magazine in another country. And the editor of that magazine wrote me a letter and said, kid, you've got potential. Stop wasting your time writing these wiseacre letters when you could be writing wiseacre record reviews. But I never wanted to do this. I didn't know I could do it. I didn't know that I had talent. I didn't know that. I mean... I was not interested it wasn't even anything. I mean, this book wouldn't have existed. Nothing would have existed if it hadn't been for Lester Bangs selflessly handing out, extending his hand and saying, come write for my magazine. It was extraordinary.
You mentioned back there that you'd written when you saw the Stones in 72, and that must have been an experience. And you'd written a review for your own entertainment. So we fast forward to 1974, 1975, and now you're doing it, and you're doing it professionally, getting paid for it. Did you approach that differently? Did you now think, did it put more pressure on you because you're now writing, it's going to be published? So does that not put pressure on you're young and probably, your hair was probably past your shoulders at that point?
Here's the punchline again. I didn't get paid for it. For the first year, now I was, when I started writing for Cream in late 1975, I ended up having my writing in every issue of the magazine from 1975 until the magazine initially folded for 13 years until 1988. Then I spent another 7 years later on in the 2000s writing for the Cream magazine. So I wrote for Cream for 20 years. But here's the punchline again. I never got paid for the first year. I would pick up the magazine or at some point further down the road, they put me on the mailing list, but I would buy the magazine and my writing would be in it. And I thought this was the greatest thing in the world. This was really cool. A year later, I got an envelope in the mail with a check inside. And it is the cliche that everybody says, because I hadn't gotten paid for my reviews. I didn't even know I was supposed to get paid. All I knew is that I was in the third biggest rock magazine in America. And all of a sudden I get a check in the mail. And my first thought was that traditional thought that everybody has. I went, wow, and they're going to pay me for this too?
So what was it like then? When did you start to do your first, if you like, because you are known for your interviews and getting hold of perhaps, you know, rock stars in a way they hadn't been, if I can phrase this correctly, hadn't been interviewed before and getting under the skin and finding out some bits and pieces. What did you just go in there and think, okay, this is how I'm going to play it. I'm just going to ask the questions and get them to, rather than doing the standard PR chat.
Well, I didn't get published in Cream until I think October or November of 1975. But in the year between Lester Bangs sending me a letter and me actually being published in the magazine, I just went around and told everybody that I was writing for Cream magazine. So when Kiss came to town on their first tour, I just went up to the manager and I said, I went to the promoter and I met him in his office and I said, I write for Cream. Give me a couple of tickets for the show. And then he gave me a ticket to the show. And then I just walked backstage to talk to Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley and their groupies. And I just bluffed my way in and said, I'm writing for Cream. Now, I hadn't been published in Cream. I wasn't going to be published for a year. But I didn't realize until much later that my first rock and roll interview was Kiss. And I just walked backstage at this Peeler Palace, and I just started talking to them. But because I grew up reading Mad Magazine. I grew up on the work of Harvey Kurtzman and Will Elder, and I read Famous Monsters of Filmland, and I knew all of this pop culture. And I always responded to rock and rollers and music on a pop culture level. So you have a bunch of guys, and they're in a band, and they sort of look like the Beatles, and they're dressed like monsters. Well, I can understand this. So I went backstage to talk to them because I thought they were a very cool band. But I always talked to them on a pop culture level. And I always talked to them as a fan. So when Gene Simmons tried to trap me and ask me what the first vampire movie is, knowing that I'm going to say Dracula, and I knew that it was F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, and he was taken aback.
So, I mean,
he was also grievously taken aback that I had seen the Beatles 10 years earlier, and he was very grievously upset and regretted that that's the one thing that he had never done.
I mean, when you approach these interviews, I mean, some of these guys are surrounded by yes men, especially in the late 70s. I mean, we're talking some big names here, talking Bowie, Iggy, etc. Did you find it easy to, or quite a challenge to get past the ego? I mean, would it have been quite easy? Because looking at the back of the book, and it's got these pictures from the girl from Transition Vamp, and I'm trying to work out there because I haven't been handed the book yet. But basically, people are saying everybody's embittered by dealing with you. Alice Cooper saying lies, lies, lies. Now you've done the book on Alice, so what's the story there?
Well, I'll tell you the secret towards interviewing, how I approached everything. First of all, the first thing is, Giles, I only interviewed people that I was a fan of. So I always self-assigned myself work. So everything that's in Rock Critic Confidential.
Yeah.
Which is published by New Haven Publishing, and it's available now.
We got that. Then we'll say that again before the end of the interview. Don't worry about that.
Now, here's the thing. I only interviewed people that I was a fan of.
Right.
And I will only interview people that I wanted to get their autograph. That's the main reason why I wanted to talk to these people, because it's the only opportunity a schlub like me would ever get to meet my favorite rock stars. Now, as it happened, I had all their records. I knew their careers inside out. I knew everything about them. And I brought all my records to every interview so I could get my records autographed. But here's the trick, and I found this to be true. If you go, in my instance, anyway, if you go and meet, because Lester Bangs famously said, the rock star is not your friend. Every rock star is my friend. And if you go to an interview and they know that you have bought all their records and that you know their career inside out and that you're not doing it as a job to pay the bills and somebody assigned it to you and you could care less about them, but it's an assignment and you've got to do it. If you go there and you know their career and you bought their records, and they know that you're one of the guys that helped make them become a millionaire, and that you're on their side, and that you're a fan, you can ask them anything. And they will answer you straight and honest, because they know that without me, they're nothing. They know I'm a fan, and no matter how hard the question is, they know I'm asking it as a fan, which is why I could ask Ian Hunter, for example. I once asked Ian Hunter, I said, how does it feel to have all your albums deleted?
Right.
And to anybody else asking him that, that would be an abrasive pick-a-fight question. But he knew that I'd bought all his albums, and he knew that I knew that they were deleted. And he answered me. And everybody I ever interviewed was a champ, and they answered me straight and solid and talked to me as a peer because they knew that I was a fan and I cared about them and I cared about their career.
I mean, the next question up, though, is they always say you should never meet your heroes. And if you are a fan, and then you, I mean, I remember meeting somebody from the 80s who I was a big fan of, and I interviewed them, and they were a nightmare. I don't know if it had been a late night before or something like that, you know, and I said I'm a big fan, and they couldn't have given two hoots. So did you ever have a situation where, you know, you said that you rock up with the vinyl, which is very impressive. Did you ever have any trepidation? Somebody like a Bowie or somebody like a Freddie, for example, Freddie Mercury, did you ever think, I do hope that they are as charming or otherworldly as you have built this image up? Because we have these images of our rock stars, you know, from afar, we imagine we know them because we listen to their music, we listen to their lyrics, we think they speak to us and us directly.
No, I knew they would be cool. I know that they would be smart enough to realize that I was, and this is the point, I never, ever refer to myself as a journalist. I'm a rock critic. I'm a fan. So when I walk in there, I always know that they're going to appreciate the fact that I'm not getting their records for free. I'm paying their money. I made them a millionaire. And they knew that. They knew I was a fan. So it would be the same thing as talking to me is the same thing as paying however exorbitant amount of money people pay now to meet somebody at a meet and greet backstage. They know that the person that's there paid a lot of money and is a fan of theirs. And that worked for me. Because I was a fan of them, and I asked questions that I couldn't get the answer to anywhere else. But I always had faith that these would be great people. I mean, for example, in the book, there's this interview, what's more like an interrogation,
right,
with Gary Numan. Now, I spoke to Gary Numan in 1980 when he was at the height of his arena-packing career. And I walked in, and I'm a huge Gary Numan fan, and I walked in with a photographer, a tape recorder, a 4 or 5 page questionnaire, and about a dozen Rorschach inkblot tests.
Okay.
And I gave him the inkblot tests. I gave him the questionnaire. He sat there silently and filled it out. And then I interviewed him, and he never blinked an eye. He never said, what's this, or anything. He just took it in stride. The man was a champ. There's no reason why he would do that at the height of his career, to have some stranger walk in with a photographer, a tape recorder, inkblot test, a written questionnaire, then an interview, and he just took it in stride like it was just everything that, you know, he's been living his life up to that point, almost like it was performance art. He never batted an eye. I just did it, and he went with it, and the man was a champ. And I knew he would go with it. I listened to his records. I knew that if I walked in with a dozen ink blots and a written questionnaire, he'd go for it, and the man did. And I can't say enough about someone like Gary Numan or anybody else who has given me the time of day and been a straight shooter.
I'm looking at the front cover of the book. There's a picture of a certain Miss Courtney Love. Now, for many people, she would seem to be, you know, a very difficult subject to interview. She has a history. She is highly intelligent, highly opinionated. How did it go with you?
I never met the lady, but I was very good friends with the man who took that photograph, who is Robert Matthew, and he took about 500 different magazine and book covers and record covers, and he took that photograph, and the reason I put it on the cover, Robert's not with us anymore, and I miss him dearly, and also Robert wrote the introduction to the book. It's the last thing that he wrote before he tragically died, but the reason I put that on the cover is because more than any other photograph I've ever seen, that photograph to me is the very embodiment of rock and roll. You've got a half-naked woman in panties in leather boots, in a sheepherder's jacket, looking completely wasted, smoking a cigarette with lipstick all over the place. And I said, that's rock and roll. That's my cover.
The images are also important, because this is a coffee table book. Now, rock stars have done several things on coffee tables, on, around, off, and under. But this is a great way of doing it as well, because it is something that the photographs are brilliant, and they go along with your humble writing so well.
Well, the thing about it that actually I'm more interested in is the fact that it isn't the fact that I'm a writer. What I'm more interested in, of more importance to me, are the photographs, because between 1974 and 1989, I took over 1,000 photographs at various rock concerts, and they were photographs of rock stars in their youthful prime, like David Bowie, Lou Reed, Freddie Mercury, Paul McCartney, The Who, Rolling Stones, Bob Dylan, Alice Cooper, Iggy Pop, Debbie Harry, Susie Quattro, George Harrison, Miles Davis, James Brown, Bruce Springsteen, the New York Dolls, and countless others. And I took all these photos as souvenirs in black and white and in color, and I filed them away in a shoebox for 50 years. And every so often I would bring them out, and they are honestly, it's no exaggeration, they are basically world-class professional photos. But I knew what I was doing, and I took them as souvenirs, and people kept saying to me, well, why don't you do something with these? Because half the people have died already, so over the period of time, they stopped being photographs, and they became historical artifacts. And people said, why don't you put them out in a book? And so I decided to do a combination of the two and have my writing and over 200 previously unpublished photos of every rock star in the book that I was a fan of. Like I said, The Who, Bowie, Queen, Rolling Stones, and they were all in their youthful prime. And I figured that's the key to make the book. It's not really the writing, it's the photography. That's what interests me the most.
You talked about being blessed. Do you think you were particularly blessed? Because this is a golden time for writing and for music, and you've got that fascinating period as if you like the first wave. You talk about the Beatles and the Beatles, the 60s wind down, the 70s pick up, and we go into the 80s. And now, in a world where every star that we like is Instagramming, Snapchat, whatever they're doing, and there's an army of PR people to get through and get at, then you taking, pictures on a camera and having these intimate conversations and these, because you can't set up with a playlist and go, look, I've downloaded your songs 18,000 times and you've got the real vinyl. Do you think you were particularly lucky and fortunate to be, where you were when you were?
Oh, blessed. I was extremely blessed to be able to do this because, like I said, first of all, I wasn't interested in writing. That was given to me by Lester Bangs. And the only reason I took these photographs was to have a souvenir. So when I got to the age that I am now, I could remember what the concerts were like. So 50 years later, to be able to combine the photographs that I took at the rock concerts with the rock writing and combine them into a coffee table book, which is basically the first coffee table book that's ever been written by somebody who's a writer and photographer. There are a lot of photography books that are captioned and have little stories by people who are basically, their career was as a photographer. There are countless rock writing books, but nobody took any photos. So that's why I'm also blessed to have this as a coffee table book, because it's a combination of the two. And I wanted to put out the kind of book that would have come out in the 1970s that you would have bought, and today you would pull it off your shelf and look at it and go, yeah, this is a pretty cool book, but man, they could never publish anything like this today. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to have the kind of book that looks like a large format rock magazine read, but the content of it would be something that people would say, oh man, I mean, just the cover alone. People would say, oh man, you couldn't do that today.
Wow.
And that's exactly what I wanted to do.
And that's exactly what you have done. Just explain to me though about this is some quotes and some pullouts. Bob Ezrin, the record producer, has a quote for you saying, I cordially invite Jeffrey to join us at our Taekwondo class any day of the week just to say hello to all the guys up here. Tongue in cheek, or did you upset him somewhat?
I upset him somewhat because I love Bob Ezrin. I mean, I love rock and roll. So putting another quarter in the jukebox, man. But The problem I had with Bob Ezrin is now, you see, I love Bob Ezrin's work. I mean, there's no Alice Cooper without Bob Ezrin. Bob Ezrin's great. But then he produced Kiss Destroyer. And it was sort of had this Baroque Phil Spector, over-the-top, sterilized sound, and more importantly, because I was a snotty rock critic who knew everything back then, or so I thought, I was getting a little sick and tired of Bob Ezrin putting his kids on every single album. And I said this, I reviewed it for Cream, and I said, you know, like, what's with Bob Ezrin putting, you know, and I said the guitars are of a sterilized Welcome to My Nightmare caliber, and how come Bob gets to put his kids on every album that he produces? So Bob, of course, having a great sense of humor, wrote that.
and
Pete Townshend.
Yes, that was my next question. That was my next question, yeah.
Well, I got tricked. Before I started writing for Cream, somebody had written a record review in Cream, which was called Lou Reed Sings Gilbert and Sullivan.
Oh, blimey. I love it already.
And it was on RCA. And it took me probably 20 minutes to half an hour to realize that this was a goof and the record didn't exist. And I thought, okay, you suckered me. So I, as a goof, not for publication, I did it as a private joke. I wrote a record review called Bible One, which was about Pete Townshend writing the first 15 albums about the first number of books in the Bible, and he was doing that as a rock opera, and I sent it to Lester Bangs as a goof, as a way of saying, this is my payback for you fooling me.
Oh, no.
And then the joke was on me, because a couple of months later, I opened it up, and he had printed the review, and he gave me my own byline, and then 2 years later, Pete Townshend wrote into Cream complaining that Who Freaks kept asking him when the Bible was going to come out. And his famous quote, which is basically also an encapsulation of my entire writing career, he said, when are you going to realize that people actually believe what you print in that magazine of yours?
Ah, brilliant. Absolutely. I just got the image of Pete Townshend scribbling the first, you know, the first couple of the books of Genesis, the first couple of books of the Bible as a rock opera. Actually makes perfect sense, my friend.
Well, it was a joke, you know, and I never write anything out of spider hatred. It was like, I love Quadrophenia. Yeah. Quadrophenia got me and so many other people through difficult times. And I thought, well, this is fine. And this is the point. Everything that I've ever really written has been to entertain people and to put a smile on their face. And if they get informed along the way, that's great. But I'm there to entertain people, to, you know, because some people may be suffering from an illness. They might have a headache. They might be depressed. They might be having a bad day. And if they can read something that I wrote and it makes them laugh and it puts a smile on their face, then I feel that I'm doing God's work and I'm helping somebody. I never write anything to teach them a lesson or to instruct them. Or as in your interview with Bonnie Hoskins, I'm not a gatekeeper. I'm an entertainer. I want to make people laugh, I want to make them smile, and I use rock and roll as the vehicle to do that. But it's always from a position of reverence and respect. I love rock and roll. And rock and roll has been just astonishingly great, great to me my entire life.
I just want to finish, because you have written the authorized biographies of both Alice Cooper and Iggy Pop. I mean, just what is that like? Because obviously Iggy is somebody that, you know, that I have a great reverence for, and I just wish you could meet in person. So what is it like to deal with them on a project?
It's astonishing, because I grew up, and in the days of vinyl, you know what it's like, Giles, to wear out an album.
Oh yeah.
And I wore out multiple copies of Killer, and I wore out multiple copies of Raw Power, which is why when they invented the compact disc, I thought this was silly, because it's like, I only get to buy this record once, and that's it from now on. I bought 3 or 4 copies of these albums. So for a kid in high school, a teenager, who bought multiple copies of Killer and multiple copies of Raw Power to end up being the authorized biography of two of his biggest rock heroes, especially Alice, because you'll see in the book, there's a photo of me dressed up in top hat and tails with a cane and kid gloves. I dressed up like Alice Cooper for a high school, you know, performance in 1974. And so for me to ever end up knowing Alice, meeting Alice and being his biographer is just astonishing. It's just a blessing.
This book is...
It's humbling. It is actually just humbling. It makes you want to just walk on eggshells and just hold your breath.
It's made me want to go and dust off a couple of bits of vinyl and play them really loud when I leave this station. This book is called Rock Critic. I've been saying cricket all day. It's my Britishness, you know. Rock Cricket Confidential. I'll get it right. It's by Geoffrey Morgan. I've had the honour to speak to today. You can find it on New Haven Books. Geoffrey, if people want to find you on the internet thing, on Twitter, how can they find you?
I'll tell you, Charles, I thank you for asking. I just finished writing a 92,000-word transgressive noir crime novel, so if anybody knows of a literary agent who can help me, or if anybody wants me to write for them, they can reach me at rockcritic@yahoo.com.
Brilliant. Well, this book is called Rock Critic Confidential. It's by Geoffrey Morgan. Geoffrey, it's been an absolute pleasure to speak to you today, and I'm going to put another dime in the jukebox, baby, and play out some Joan Jett. Geoffrey, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Giles. I appreciate your interest, and I appreciate you calling me all the way from sunny Spain. Sir, it's an honor.
The record machine. I knew he must have been about 17. He was strong, playing my favorite song, and I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me, yeah me. And I could tell it wouldn't be long that he was with me. His name, that don't matter, he said, 'cause it's all the same. So can I take you home where we can be alone? Next we're moving on, he was with me, yeah me. Next we're moving on.